I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Midday. 2 weeks into the trial of Baltimore police officer William Porter, with probably less than a week to go, what have we learned from testimony? Will the different timelines offered by the prosecution and the defense about when Freddie Gray was injured confuse the jury? Legal expert J. Amy Dillard offers her analysis. Plus, as United Nations climate talks in Paris push into overtime, how near is consensus? New York Times blogger Andrew Revkin fills us in. We'll hear news from the Baltimore Business Journal. And in the holiday spirit of sharing, a local effort to collect diapers for babies in need and an animal rescue adoption event tomorrow in Carroll County. That's Midday after the news. Welcome to Midday. I'm Sheila Cast, with big thanks for everyone who supported WIPR during the short fundraiser that wrapped up last night, and especially thanks to our new sustaining members. You make everything WIPR does possible, and we're very grateful. Later this hour, we'll hear about charitable efforts in our area this weekend. We'll also talk about new businesses moving to the Inner Harbor. And Andrew Revkin, author of the .earth blog of the New York Times, will give us a wrap-up about the Paris climate talks. But let's start our roundup with the trial of Officer William Porter, one of six police officers charged in the death of Freddie Gray. Among those who testified during this second week of the trial was Officer Porter. He's been charged with involuntary manslaughter, second-degree assault, reckless endangerment, and misconduct in office for the death of Freddie Gray last April. Gray died from a broken neck suffered while he was being transported in the back of a police wagon. Prosecutors say Porter neglected his job by not doing enough to help Gray. They've pointed to police policy requiring all detainees to be seatbelted, and witnesses for the state say Gray might have lived had he received immediate medical attention. Joining us to analyze Porter's testimony and other testimony is J. Amy Dillard. She's Associate Professor of Law at the University of Baltimore, and she's an expert in criminal defense. She worked as a deputy public defender in Alexandria, Virginia, and she served on independent review panels of police incidents. Welcome back to the show, Amy.
Happy to be here.
If experts can establish that there's nothing that Porter could have done to assist Gray medically, if the injury that Gray suffered was catastrophic immediately, does that let him off the hook?
I don't know that it lets him off the hook, but it does complicate the prosecution's case against him. I think that when we think about causes of death, and I'm talking now from the point of view of a coroner or from the medical experts, that where there is agreement on exactly what the cause of death was, let's say a catastrophic broken neck, from which there could be no successful treatment or life-saving treatment, I think that diminishes the strength of the prosecutor's case against Porter for failing to call immediately for medical care.
Officer Porter said he has been involved in 150 arrests and has never once seatbelted a detainee. Another police officer, Zachary Novak, testified for the defense that only about 10% of the time are detainees seatbelted. So not fastening a seatbelt around a detainee against department policy, according to testimony, but does that rise to a criminal violation?
Well, that's going to be a question for the jury. And, you know, this is all the testimony that the jury is going to consider when it tries to determine what is reasonable or really what is unreasonable conduct for an officer. You know, the government is able to establish that these are policies that are in place, that they're taught at the academy, that they are they're retested on, you know, every year, this sort of updating on police procedure for how to detain people. And this seems like a pretty standard approach to how to secure a suspect in the back of one of these vans. In contradiction to that, though, we've got the officer saying, yeah, we all know that, but the practice in the field is we don't buckle them in, and they have reasons for not buckling them in. I think the jury, that's just a pure question of fact about whether that's reasonable conduct by the officers or not. You know, and there are times when you get this argument that the community, the officers themselves build standards that are, you know, applied on a regular basis that are distinct from those standards that might be in writing. You know, a good example of that would be the posted speed limit might be 50, but every driver is going 55.
Okay. I can still get a ticket.
Yes, you certainly can get a ticket. But the question of the degree of unreasonableness in that conduct might be something more debatable in a jury room.
One of the things that I am struggling, probably overstates it, but I'm confused as this trial unfolds. Officer Porter testified that he recommended that Gray be taken to the hospital, but that he couldn't order the driver, Caesar Goodson, mm-hmm. to do this. He says that that was the responsibility of the driver of the van.
Mm-hmm.
How can this testimony, or does will any of this affect Officer Goodson's trial, which is the next trial coming up in January?
Not that I can see at this point, meaning that Officer Goodson's trial is completely independent. There may be witnesses that were called in Officer Porter's trial that will be recalled. But best I can tell, you know, the government's not going to be able to force Officer Porter to testify in Officer Goodson's trial. And even if they could try to get that testimony in another way, the fact that there could still be a federal civil rights trial might still give him a Fifth Amendment privilege to keep what he has said in his trial to only his words and nothing more. So I don't see that there's a crossover at this point. Now, we may get evidentiary arguments that are made prior to the trial of Officer Goodson about Porter's testimony, but right now I don't see that there's any overlap.
I'm not sure what you mean by we may get evidentiary arguments about Officer Porter's testimony.
Well, so let's say that that Officer Porter has testified in his own trial in a way that might be harmful to the defense of Goodson, meaning that if the government could to prosecute Goodson, the government might call Officer Porter to testify, well, I told him to take him to the hospital and he didn't do it. Mm-hmm. Right, that might help the government's prosecution of Officer Goodson. The government, because Officer Porter is a criminal defendant and has Fifth Amendment privileges to remain silent, and because he might be a criminal defendant in a future federal case, that privilege to remain silent still stays with him.
Mm-hmm.
The government can't force him to testify in Goodson's trial. And so that's how I see that they may remain distinct.
Right. I understood that, but then I didn't. You said you offered as I thought perhaps a different approach or another window.
So there is an argument that the testimony that Officer Porter gave in his own trial, could that be used in the trial of Goodson? And I'll leave it at it's a very sticky evidentiary question and one that I would anticipate will be litigated prior to Goodson's trial.
I see. In other words, could they read that transcript?
Exactly.
I see. And of course, the lawyers on both sides have been under a gag order by Judge Williams.
Mm-hmm.
They're not talking in any way to reporters. After this trial is over, would jurors be able to talk about their decision and how they reached it?
It'll depend on what the judge says. You know, typically, jurors are not required to speak with anyone,
sure,
counsel or otherwise, and they're allowed to speak with anyone they want to. I could imagine in this case the judge ordering them not to speak with anyone and maybe putting a time limit on that until after the other trials are done. I can certainly imagine that in order to, you know, keep the potential of, you know, continuing to bias or contaminate the potential jury pool for the other trials down to a minimum.
Some people were surprised when that Officer Porter took the stand. Did you? I mean, obviously, I know they said a few weeks ahead of time that he would, so I'm not saying his appearance on the day in court was a surprise. But as a strategy, did you expect that?
Well, I think in these cases where the jury is tasked with determining determining whether or not conduct was reasonable or criminally negligent, it strikes me as a very a typical strategy for the defendant himself to speak, meaning that the jury is left with a vacuum of what was in the mind of Officer Porter if he doesn't testify, and then that vacuum, you know, gets filled with the argument of the prosecutor. Now, he still has a presumption of innocence in all of that, but I do think that his words saying, "This is what was in my mind while I was acting and interacting with Freddie Gray," offers the jury something concrete when it discusses what his duty was, or whether he failed to perform a duty that he was required to do by law.
And what is your assessment of his testimony in his own defense now that it's been public? Well, do you think he helped himself?
Well, so this is one of those cases where I've talked to so many people about it, and we all sort of come at it the same way, which is there are a lot of facts that are being pushed into this case, and it's hard to see exactly how they're going to line up with the theories that are going to be argued to the jury. Certainly, the facts help Officer Porter in terms of the jury having an understanding of what may have been going on in his mind, or what he says was going on in his mind. Everything from, "I don't typically buckle people, other people don't typically buckle people," when I interacted with him, I thought that he was pretending or something that he had done in the past. And then, you know, I thought that I needed to tell the driver to take care of him as opposed to, you know, doing some sort of larger intervention to take care of him. Yeah, that tells us a lot about his state of mind. And, you know, the defense counsel, I assume, is going to argue to the jury that all of his perceptions and the way he thought through what he was presented with were reasonable in that moment. You might make different choices now. Knowing what you know now, would you do something differently? But that's not the question in a criminal prosecution. You know, the question is, at that moment, what was in your mind? What were you perceiving? What did you think? What did you do? And I think his argument is going to be that he did not fail to perform a duty that he knew about, because he did perform it when he told Goodson to, you know, take care of the guy medically.
Given that Officer Porter testified for himself, what about the more than two dozen character witnesses that the defense has listed that they may call? What would be the purpose of these witnesses, and is it likely that all of them would be called?
Yeah, so character witnesses are usually allowed only to testify about reputations for truthfulness, reputations in the community for truthfulness. So it's an opportunity to say to the jury, you have a reason to believe the testimony of this particular witness. I suppose they could also be called if the government has any rebuttal evidence that that Officer Porter had a tendency to be aggressive. They could be called to try to rebut that as well. But I haven't seen any of that kind of testimony yet.
So that could come near the end. So it could be the character witnesses, the defense would call them near the end of the trial.
Yes, near the end of the trial.
And speaking of the end of the trial,
yeah.
Judge Williams basically promised the jury that Porter's trial would not go later than December 17th, which
mm-hmm.
is next Thursday.
Mm-hmm.
How could he make such a firm prediction?
Well, yeah, I talked to some people about this when he said that at the beginning of the voir dire. That's typical for judges to do. And as somebody who's tried cases around holidays, it's even more typical for judges to do that around holidays. To be able to say to jurors, look, we need to know if you have a conflict that makes it impossible for you to sit, but I want to tell you that this is how long this trial is going to last so that you're not speculating about impossibility. And I'm sure that the judge has had numerous pretrial conferences with the prosecution and the defense about exactly witnesses they plan to call and how long they thought it was going to take, and then built in some buffer days on that. And I'm sure that if something extraordinary happens and it goes beyond that, that the judge will accommodate the jurors as necessary.
Well, I mean, I can completely understand how a judge could have a pretty good idea about testimony and how much time is going to be needed. I would think the jury's deliberations are much harder to assign a projected time to.
That's certainly true. But we all, well, I don't want to say always, but, you know, anybody who has experience doing this kind of work, you sort of know the parameters of what is typical, and then you can add on to that, what if this was more extraordinary? What if it took 45 hours as opposed to 7 hours and that sort of thing? I assume that he did that calculation with counsel as he went through this.
Amy Dillard, thank you so much for your insights on this.
Happy to help.
J. Amy Dillard is Associate Professor of Criminal Law at the University of Baltimore Law School. I'm Sheila Cass. This is Midday on WIPR. We need to take a short break, and when we return, we'll get a crash course through the two-week-long climate change conference in Paris with New York Times.Earth reporter Andrew Refkin. And we'll get business news update from the Baltimore Business Journal. So stay with us. Welcome back to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. I'm glad you're with us. For the past 2 weeks, something like 30,000 people have gathered in Paris for the climate change conference. The goal of the conference is to reach a concise agreement that would reduce carbon emissions and the harm done to the areas most vulnerable to climate change, while somehow satisfying the leaders of nearly 200 countries. And not surprisingly, reaching that goal has been as hard as it sounds. This morning, it was announced the deal would not be reached today. It would be reached, they think, tomorrow. Joining us by phone is environmental reporter Andrew Refkin. He is Senior Fellow for Environmental Understanding at Pace University in New York, where he teaches environmental documentary courses. He also writes the New York Times.Earth blog, and he's been updating it frequently these past few weeks to keep us up to date about the climate talks. Andrew Refkin, welcome to Midday.
Great to be with you.
You have been reporting for at least a week that the negotiators would not wrap up today. How close to an agreement do you think they are?
Well, you know, it's one of these issues where to get agreement among nearly 200 countries on something as epic as taking the carbon out of the global energy menu, you know, which is still more than 80% fossil fuels, you've got to have a lot of waffle words. It's just like, there's just no other way. There's so many divergent interests in play. Countries that are really poor and vulnerable feel powerless. They want more money. The treaty has to accommodate their demands to some extent for aid from countries that spent 100 years, like us, burning fossil fuels and getting rich. That's just one of the many reasons why the language will be nuanced. But at the same time, you know, there's this pressure from the science that says if you don't get beyond verbiage and actually have change on the ground, we're in for profound changes on the planet.
Right. I understand that. And that's what we've been hearing now for 2 weeks, that it's really hard to do. And that's why I'm curious as to somebody like you who's looking closely at the sort of interim, what seem to be agreements along the way, whether something seems to be shaping up.
Well, it has already. I think I wrote at some point, and it's certainly been clear that what the big accomplishment that will make Paris on a certain level a success is what happened a year ago between China and the United States when they pledged, put out in parallel their plans with some detail on how they're going to change, sort of divert from business as usual, even more than the United States had been planning to, and China has, you know, announced the peak in its emissions and a planned peak in a couple of decades, and that then inspired other countries. More than 180 countries have put forward their own intended contributions, and that all is that, you know, some of that reflects changes that wouldn't have happened otherwise, which is why the treaty process still has value. I don't personally pay too much attention to the dots and dashes because in covering this issue since the 1980s, you know, since before there was the first treaty back at the Earth Summit in 1992, I've become more and more aware of the scope of this issue. It's, you know, it's not like resolving a trade dispute. It's not even like resolving a Middle East dispute. it's well, maybe it is. Actually, maybe that's the closest thing. It's epic. And the process is finally recognizing that. There was this sort of magical thinking that persisted until the meeting in Paris, in Copenhagen in 2009, that you could have sort of an old-fashioned 20th century-style treaty with all kinds of complicated clauses that would then establish a global threshold limit for emissions, and everyone would hew to those norms, and we'd go forward. It's just a different kind of problem. So it's iterative. It is. There's a woman named Kelly Levin, who's at World Resources Institute. When she was a doctoral student at Yale, she wrote this paper in 2007, calling the climate problem a super wicked problem. And she called for, and this is what's happening, progressive incrementalism. That word sounds so yucky and mushy, and
it really does.
But it is. You can create norms that then have durability, that then countries do tend to act a little bit more when they're all acting together. In this 21st century, with so much transparency imposable on countries, you know, you can't really lie about your deforestation rate anymore, for example, because satellites find it. China has recognized that it needs to be more honest about its reporting on coal use and its emissions, and that just came out ahead of the Paris talk. It's just kind of harder to cheat, and so I think that all will build towards changes. And again, you know, this is not like a one city, one meeting, one president, one Congress problem. It's bigger than that.
It is big, but would you expect that the agreement that's being shaped before your eyes in Paris will be? Translated into legislative mandates in the countries?
It works the other way. That's the big shift, I think, that has been profound between Copenhagen 2009 and Paris here in 2015, 2016, that the treaty process is reflecting what countries can do domestically and what they're willing to put forward in language that they submit. Remember that the word intended is in there. That's not going to go away. These are not going to be mandatory on a global scale. There's no global carbon police who will come and, force you to write a check or change your power plants. It ultimately, the changes in energy systems will happen nationally, domestically. And this treaty process, more and more, is reflecting what countries are choosing to do rather than determining what they do.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, and you can look at that and say, it's a total fail. But, or you can look at that and say, this is the beginning of the human species recognizing that it has to think on longer timescales. It has to recognize that actions have unfairly, our energy abundance and wealth has unfairly added to risks in other places that don't have energy and have vulnerability. And we need to do more about that. But it's not like it's not going to happen from the top down. It's just not that kind of process.
One last factor in all this that I want to run past you before I let you go. In a speech last week, President Obama linked terrorism to climate change. In your view, is this an accurate link? And how was it addressed at the conference?
Well, the most recent argument for that comes out of Syria, where the drought contributed to turmoil that contributed to some of the disruption that's happened there. I wrote about that in the context, right after 9/11, I wrote about this in the context of Afghanistan, where a really potent drought that was more linked to El Nino, this periodic wiggle in the oceans, clearly fostered conditions that helped the Taliban rise in the rural areas of Afghanistan. So you can have environmental stress can produce or can contribute to other problems like that, absolutely. Whether it's climate change or just some unusual, you know, the question gets down to looking at Syria's climate and weather patterns and you know, whether the global warming issue was in play there. It is easy and justified to say that in a world with a powerfully changing climate system and coastal stresses from rising seas, there you're really contributing to risk like that. But it's never going to be sort of simple as like it's the driver or the cause.
Andrew Revkin, I appreciate your walking us through this. Thanks a lot.
Great. Take care.
Andrew Revkin writes the New York Times .earth blog. He's a senior fellow for environmental understanding at Pace University in New York. He teaches environmental documentary courses. And now from climate change to business developments in Baltimore, Jonathan Munshaw, associate editor of the Baltimore Business Journal, is here with me in the studio. Welcome back.
Thank you for having me on again.
So there's been some shifting around of businesses at Harbor Place, additions of some new restaurants, location changes, renovations for the visitor center. Catch us up.
Sure. So at least with the Light Street Pavilion, the latest thing is that in the old J. Paul location, right now it's Santa's Village, actually. It used to be the J. Paul's restaurant, I believe it was called. It used to be like a seafood restaurant. And now it's actually home to Santa, at least through January, where people can go and take pictures. And then after that moves out, there's a new restaurant coming in called Yard House. It's a chain. It has about 50 locations so far. This will be the first one in Maryland. I think the closest location right now would be in Virginia. I'm not sure which city in Virginia. And they're basically known as kind of like a tap house. They have like 100 beers to choose from, and they serve like general pub food. And then part of those changes as well, Hooters is moving down from the second floor to the first floor. I think we reported on that probably like 3 or 4 months ago. So that's not necessarily new, but that's part of the shift that's going on there. And there is going to be a larger overhaul of both the Pratt Street Pavilion and the Light Street Pavilion in the next couple of years. There's not really a concrete timetable for that just yet, but basically complete renovations of both spaces are coming.
But it's still, Harbor Place is still going to be primarily franchises of big national chains, right?
Yeah, at least for the time being. This Yard House is the most recent one that we know about. Certainly there could be changes when these renovations take place, but based upon the leases, a lot of the restaurants that are there are going to stay around, at least for the foreseeable future.
Is it just too expensive at Harbor Place that for a local business to get a toehold there?
Frankly, I don't know what the rent rates are or anything like that, and I'm not really even sure what factors played into this Yard House moving in. But you know, certainly you would have to assume that rent rates would be higher. We actually just ran a story this week that Pratt Street is becoming one of the most expensive streets in the entire country. And so certainly that plays into it too, is that with the waterfront, office space, lease space for businesses, all those sorts of things make Pratt Street one of the most expensive locations.
Right. And the visitor center is being renovated. You wrote about that.
Yeah, that's going to become kind of like a dual-use building from now on. Right now, most people know it as like the place where tourists can go and get their brochures and ask questions to volunteers and things like that, people who are brand new to the city. And now, under some renovations, it's going to become that tourist space. It'll stay that space during the day, and then at night, it'll become an event space. So my understanding right now, what they're doing in terms of the renovations is they're taking out the permanent brochure cases that are in there that are like physically attached to the floor, and they're replacing them with cases that can be moved basically just like on wheels, that they can move in and out of the building, that they can put into storage at night, that'll open up the building, make the floor, give it a lot more floor space, and people can rent out the space for events. They haven't had a fire marshal come in there yet, so they don't really know how many people it'll be able to hold or what they might be charging for these events, but when I talked to Tom Noonan, who's the CEO of Visit Baltimore, which is like the tourism arm of Baltimore City, he said that he expects like a huge range of events to be in there. He mentioned weddings, corporate events. He said even like around this time of the year, people could rent it out for office parties and things like that.
Hmm. That's something to watch for. One other thing I wanted you to update us on. Rick Seltzer, your colleague, when he joined us last week, told us about Amazon getting into food delivery in competition with Order Up. And can you give us the concise version of how you tested out which of those food delivery options is the better bet right now?
Sure. So I basically just ordered the same exact thing from Cheese Galore and More. It's like a cheese place, but they have sandwiches there. So I ordered the same exact thing at the same exact time from Order Up and Amazon. It was both around noon, and I recorded the times that they got there. So Order Up's three sandwiches got there at about, I think it was like 40 minutes after I had ordered them, and Amazon's took about an hour and 10 minutes.
And the cost was different, too. do I have this right, that Order Up charged more for some of the additions you made to your sandwiches, but Amazon's delivery was free because you've got Amazon Prime, right?
Right. Well, yeah, it was a little complicated. I never even really got an explanation as to why it was different, but I like added bacon onto the sandwiches, and for some reason the bacon from Order Up was more expensive than Amazon by like 25 cents. I have no idea why. And yeah, Amazon Prime, you have to pay a $99 membership fee initially. You have to pay that. That's like a yearly fee. And all of the delivery for that is free. But the difference in price as well comes with that Amazon, for most of their restaurants, I don't know if this is just like a company policy or just how it's working out in Baltimore, but it has a $20 spending limit. Like, you have to spend $20 before they'll deliver food to you.
A minimum order.
Yeah. So, and Order Up has those as well, but it's on a restaurant-by-restaurant basis.
So in the case of Cheese Galore and more, that would have been lower. But the impression that you left me with was that customer service was your key reason for saying at this point you would stick with Order Up.
Yeah, that was kind of like the weirdest thing to me. As I'm sure everyone knows, Amazon's headquarters is in Seattle. And when I had a question about my order, they had initially called me to tell me that the driver was, in fact, going to be late past the expected delivery time that they had given me. And when they called me about that, it came from Seattle. I didn't talk directly to the driver or anything like that. And then when I had a question about my order, like why it still wasn't there, and I tried contacting customer service, I had to go through Amazon's headquarters. Whereas with Order Up, the way that their drivers work...
talking to the driver.
Yeah, they call you from their cell phone, and it comes through as just like a random Baltimore number. But you can talk to the driver directly. I know, like, I live in Timonium, and when I order up from there, the drivers most of the time will call me and say, hey, I'm outside. Whereas with Amazon, it was kind of like a backward way of doing it, in my opinion. And maybe that's something that they sort out over time.
Thanks for telling us the results of your scientific survey. Thanks, Jonathan. Munshaw, associate editor of the Baltimore Business Journal. And one other quick update. This morning, the University of Maryland Board of Regents voted 12-5 to remove the name of Harry Clifton Curly Bird from the football stadium at the College Park campus. College Park University President Wallace Lowe had recommended the change and had told the Board of Regents that Bird's history of advocacy of separate but equal when he was president of the University of Maryland in College Park was painful to many African Americans on campus. We are going to take another quick break, and when we return, the largest companion animal shelter in Maryland is hitting the road this weekend. We'll find out where you can find a new addition to your family, plus an effort to provide families in need of diapers. I'm Sheila Cass. Stay with us. Welcome back to Midday, everyone. I'm Sheila Cast. Tomorrow, Baltimore Animal Rescue and Care Shelter, known as Barks, will be loading up 50-plus cats and dogs and heading to Carroll County for what they're calling the Home for the Holidays Mega Adoption Event. Barks is partnering with the Humane Society of Carroll County to host this event. All adoption fees have been waived in hopes of finding as many homes as possible for these pets. And joining me here in Studio A is Bailey Deacon, Director of Communications for Barks. Bailey, how are all these dogs and cats getting to Carroll County?
Well, we have an adoption van that we bring around to Baltimore City, but for something this size, we actually have two box trucks that have been donated to us for the journey. And so our staff is outfitting them starting tomorrow morning at 6 a.m. For a safe journey north with all these pets.
And you will end up where?
We're going to be at the Carroll County Ag Center in the Shipley Arena.
Okay, and what is the event going to look like?
Well, it's going to be really big. We're going to have over 100 cats and dogs, and then Humane Society of Carroll County is also bringing smaller companion animals like rabbits and guinea pigs. So it's going to be all types of animals, and it's going to be in the big arena. So the cats will be in their crates, able to be held, and there'll be spaces where they can meet potential adopters, and the dogs are going to be walking around just so that they can meet all the families who are coming.
The dogs are going to be walking around by themselves.
Oh, no.
Yeah, somebody from Barks with each of them.
Yep, all of our staff and volunteers. So not only is it 50 dogs and cats, but it's going to be a big overhaul. We have tons of volunteers and staff that are coming, too.
And the goal is
to find homes for these pets. They can go home that day, same day adoption, which is wonderful because then the goal is that if they don't come back with us, then they found wonderful homes and they then we have open cages so we can welcome more pets into our shelter.
Is winter a slow time for adoption?
It is. It can be a little bit slower, and we think it's just because of the weather. It's nationally, we've talked to other shelters, and it seems to be a slower time. But with the holidays are actually a great time to adopt a pet, and that's because families tend to have a little bit of extra time at home from work and school, and that helps them get acclimated better when they come into a new situation.
So how can people get involved if people care about pets and want to help in some way?
Well, there's lots of things you can do. For this event, you can adopt. If you have room in your home and your heart, you can adopt a pet during the holidays. And then we also are always looking for donations and volunteers. We are the largest animal companion shelter in Maryland, and that means 12,000 animals a year. And so that's a lot of mouths to feed.
And so just to recap, this Home for the Holidays adoption event will take place at the Carroll County Department of Agriculture. The address is 706 Agricultural Center Drive in Westminster.
Mm-hmm.
And where can people get more information, Bailey?
On our website, and that's baltimoreanimalshelter.org.
Baltimore Animal Shelter, all mm-hmm. spelled out, all
yep.
one word spelled out, .org.
.org.
Bailey Deacon is with the Baltimore Animal Shelter Rescue and Care Center. I really appreciate your telling us about it.
Thank you.
I hope it goes well. And now I want to turn to another opportunity for you to give back this weekend. Diapers can run families $70 or $80 a month. If mom and dad don't have enough diapers for their child, they risk not being able to send them to daycare or having to wait longer in between diaper changes. A group of volunteers in our area is offering a helping hand to families in need. It's called Diaper Share. Diaper Share collects diapers, repackages them, and distributes them to shelters and social service organizations in Baltimore City and Annapolis. And with us now in the studio is Elizabetha Oseba Osore. Did I get that right?
Yes, Oseba Osore.
Oseba Osore, your co-director of
yes,
Diaper Share.
Yes, correct.
Where did this idea come from?
So there are diaper banks all over the country that are doing this work. And myself and my co-director, Kate, came to Share Baby, which is our umbrella organization that we work under, with this idea of starting a diaper bank for Baltimore. Because as of August 2015, when we started, there was no such service that was providing a source of free diapers to families in need.
Yeah.
There are diaper banks in other parts of Maryland that are more rural, and there's a big one in D.C., but there was a large hole in the Baltimore area.
Let me just make sure I understand the basics here. We're talking about disposable diapers.
Correct, for babies.
So you're talking about donations from people who, for some reason, have extra diapers, or people who go out and buy diapers to give you, or?
Correct. So we accept new and open packs of diapers. So for families whose children have grown out of a certain size, we would love to take them. We also ask people to buy us new diapers if they feel so inclined. So we can accept either because we repackage them. And our goal is to get them from the people who have extra or have a little extra to give to those who are struggling to make ends meet.
And of course, many people in Baltimore don't have access to a grocery store easily. I mean, that's
right.
that's a problem for in a lot of ways. But how does that affect the cost of diapers?
So when you're buying diapers from a convenience store or a corner store, the prices are marked up because you're paying for that convenience. And oftentimes there's not reliable transportation to get you to a big box store. So you can be paying, two times what you would be paying in a big box store, plus the cost of whatever transportation it takes for you to get there. Also, diapers are not covered under WIC or food stamps. So you're paying with some sort of cash out of pocket. And if you don't have that money to stretch, it can be virtually impossible to get diapers for your child.
And so what do families tend to do if they don't have access to you?
So families, they try to pile their pennies together to get what they can. Oftentimes, babies are left in soiled diapers for longer than they should be.
What kind of health effects does that have?
So that can lead to diaper rash. It can lead to infections. It also leads to higher stress for the baby and the parents, which can cause child abuse and just, you know, mental health issues for mothers and fathers who are in these situations.
So the diapers that you collect and repackage, packages of 25, correct? Where do you distribute them?
So right now we're working with 7 partner organizations in the city and 1 in Annapolis. So we're working with Lighthouse Shelter in Annapolis, working with House of Ruth, Maryland, Turnaround, 2 locations of Sarah's Hope. 1 is Sarah's Hope Hannamore and 1 is Sarah's Hope at Mount Street. We also work with Dayspring Shelters and the Family Tree. And so we started with 7 to start small. We're a very new organization.
How new are you?
So the diaper bank, Diaper Share, started in August 2015, so this year, just a couple months. So we're hoping to expand to more programs across the city as we grow. And as of today, we've distributed 4,700 diapers.
And where can people drop off diapers for you?
So we have monthly drives. Actually, we have a drive this Sunday at the Giant in Hamden. We'll be there from 10 to 1 collecting diapers, so people can bring them from the community. They can come to Giant and buy a pack, or you can email us. But in general, we have drives once a month, and we post them on our Facebook page and also on our website.
We will link to your Facebook page from our website.
Awesome.
So, because that will tell people both where they can donate diapers and where they can get them, right?
Yes.
Eliseba Oseba Osore, I'm really glad you told us about this, and congratulations on getting this thing started.
Thank you.
She's co-director of Diaper Share. I want to thank you both for being with us, and now I want to turn to WIPR reporter Kenneth Burns, who is covering the trial of Officer Porter that we spoke about earlier in this hour. There is some news today from the courtroom. Kenny, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Sheila. The defense has rested their case. The jury has been dismissed for the day. Judge Barry Williams said that there are some legal issues that he needs to handle this afternoon. We'll start to observe that at 2:30. But this morning, we heard 4 character witnesses, including Officer William Porter's mother, Helena Porter. All together, the character witnesses were about 20 minutes in time, but the bulk of the morning was spent with Captain Justin Reynolds, who testified as an expert in police procedures. And the takeaway from his testimony is that the general orders are normally printed, emailed, discussed at roll call, and posted on a bulletin board for 5 days. And that he also backed up the defense argument.
I'm sorry. Hold that thought, Kenneth. I want to make sure I understand. Is the testimony that normally when there is a new procedure, like the email that came out to say that detainees should be buckled in, it would be publicized in more ways than this procedure was publicized among police officers?
Yes, that is the testimony. And again, for those tuning in, we're talking about Captain Justin Reynolds, a 17-year veteran of the Baltimore City Police Department, who was admitted as an expert witness in police procedure for the defense. He also backed up that the defense argument that Porter's actions were reasonable because he was a backup officer, and added that he went beyond the call of duty as a backup officer at that fourth stop at Dolphin and Druid Hill when the van driver, Officer Cesar Goodson, asked for a prisoner check.
So that was testimony this morning. And then tell us something about the character witness testimony.
We heard from 4 character witnesses this morning. The first one was Renee Somerville, who considers Porter like a grandson. The second one, actually two after that, were friends of his, Angela Gibson, a teacher in Baltimore County, and Devin Scott, a computer specialist for the state of Maryland. And those 3 preceded his mother. There was not a whole lot of that they could say. In fact, the judge had to there were some objections that were sustained from the prosecutors when they started to go into a little further detail. But all of the character witnesses said that Officer Porter was truthful and honest. His mother in particular said that he was the peacemaker in any situation that goes down.
So I'm not sure I understand procedure and process right now. I understand that the judge has sent the jury home for today and said they'd come back on Monday. So this afternoon will be spent, the judge is going to reconvene court at 2:30 to do what?
This afternoon at 2:30, the court will reconvene to discuss legal issues going into closing arguments. We just heard that the state did not exercise its right to call rebuttal witnesses, so we will not have any more witness testimony for the rest of the trial at this point. So issues, because of the gag order, we don't necessarily have that preview of what's going to be discussed between prosecutors and defense attorneys. The jury is reporting back Monday morning, and that is the earliest that closing arguments can happen. I'm not going to say we expect closing arguments because, as we've learned, anything can happen.
Well, but that's what I had leapt to the conclusion that closing arguments would start on Monday when I heard you say that there would not be any more witness testimony. I'm trying to get a sense of what else, when you say anything could happen, what else might that be? What else should we prepare for?
Well, I'll just say you made a fair assumption that closing arguments could start Monday. But like I said, what we still don't know is the specific legal issues that will be discussed among attorneys and Judge Williams this afternoon.
And closing arguments are likely to be how long? Has there been any indication of how that works?
That's possibly one of the issues that will be discussed this afternoon, how long closing arguments could be. They could be a little, they could be longer, they could be short. What I can say is that during pretrial motions, we saw Judge Barry Williams give each side 15 minutes to argue their motion. So we might get a little bit longer than 15 minutes on closing arguments, but that will likely be discussed this afternoon.
I realize, Kenny, that the lawyers aren't able, as you mentioned a minute ago, to do the kind of background briefing they sometimes, or information they sometimes share with reporters. But as someone who's been covering this trial since its beginning, would you expect this case to go to the jury on Monday?
I would expect Monday afternoon at the earliest, if not Tuesday.
Okay. Well, we will obviously keep in touch with you next week. Thank you very much for giving us this news, Kenneth.
Thank you, Sheila.
Kenneth Burns is covering the trial for WIPR. So I want to thank him. I thank Elseba Osore, co-director of Diaper Share, and Bailey Deacon with the Baltimore Animal Rescue Care Center for bringing us your news today. I want to thank Joe Squared for providing lunch for our guest today. Joe Squared serves coal-fired pizzas, risotto, and local craft beers, locations and hours at joesquared.com. And of course, thanks to you, our listeners. When Midday returns on Monday, we'll be speaking with Baltimore County Executive Kevin Kamenetz about school funding, transportation, and the importance of shopping local. Have a safe weekend and stay tuned to Here and Now.